And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business, health, and politics. Each of my guests will share his perspective on one of these subjects. My next guest explores the human capacity for both honesty and dishonesty. He explores where cheating comes from. We'll discuss his findings from the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Dan Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. Dan's work has been featured widely in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, just to name a few. He has made numerous appearances on CNN, CBS, and NPR. He lives in Durham, North Carolina, with his wife and two children, joining us from that area. Hi, Dan. How are you today?
Hello. Very well.
Thank you so much for being our guest. And let's just bring this down to a level that most of the listeners are going to understand and start with a familiar story. And that's the story of Bernie Madoff. Madoff led the largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history for decades, and he regularly cheated his investors, both his private and his public investors, out of about $18 billion. How did Madoff do it? I mean, how did he lie to his investors? And more importantly, how did he live with himself knowing that he was lying and cheating to his investors?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, even though Madoff is officially one of my neighbors, he's housed in North Carolina, I've been unable to talk to him directly. So this is all my speculation rather than his accounting. But here is a couple of things to consider. One is that when we look at the behavior of somebody like Madoff, we can say to ourselves, we would have never been able to do all of that. But of course, we're not sure that Madoff thought from the beginning about all of that. Maybe what he thought in the beginning was just about one small step. And when you phrase it like this, one small step does sound plausible. And I've talked to many other white-collar criminals, and the basic story with all of them is the same. They took one small step, they thought it would be a small step for one quarter, and then things could turn around, but then things don't turn around, and then it just goes down the rabbit hole and becomes worse and worse and worse. By the way, if Madoff was so smart and plan on cheating his investor to such a degree, don't you think he would have an exit strategy? Wouldn't he have an island somewhere with another passport and a private jet? I mean, and being able to escape more easily? The fact that he ended up where he is and the fact that his son committed suicide suggests to me that he was not planning this whole sequence of events, at least not very well. Now, there's another important aspect here, which is rationalization. It turns out that we're all masters in rationalizing the world according to how we want to view it. And what I often find is that people take the first steps in terms of being dishonest, then they rationalize it, they explain to themselves why this is actually okay, and then the next step become easier and easier and easier. Now, at some point, some people kind of realize, wake up and realize it's a big dishonest action, but by that time it's too late often, and there's no way to go back.
Well, Dan, let's stick with the Bernie Madoff story, because we would not have found out about Bernie Madoff unless he turned himself in, which is ultimately what he did. He turned himself in. That was the end of that scheme. And I would agree with you that he did not have a real well-thought-out exit strategy, but most Ponzi schemes don't. I mean, just by the very nature that it's a Ponzi scheme, they end up in tragedy, and that's what happened with Madoff. So if Madoff hadn't done it, would he have continued to rationalize this and gone to his grave rationalizing this, and only his children would have been left to deal with the consequences?
You know, I think that this is a really interesting question about what can we rationalize and what can't we rationalize. And when we do our experiments, you know, we give people a chance to steal a little bit of money from us here and there, and we see how much they can cheat and rationalize. We find that people are perfectly able to rationalize small amounts. They have a very hard time rationalizing large amounts. Now, what happens when it happens over years and you start rationalizing things over and over, and you get better at it? I think there's a good chance that if we kept on letting Madoff continue with this strategy, that he could have lived with himself for the rest of the time, probably not really understanding the full impact of what he was doing. Now, I'll tell you why I think it was probably so easy for him to rationalize it. One of the things we find is that as the distance between an action and its consequences become larger, people are better able to rationalize. So here's a simple example. Imagine you play golf and you want to move the ball by 4 inches. Mm-hmm. And you could pick it up and you can move it 4 inches. People think this is just morally outrageous. People think, I would never do it. Nobody ever does it. This is just something terrible. On the other hand, you can say, what if you would kick the ball a little bit with your shoe? People say, oh, this is much better. I can see myself doing it. And what if you hit your ball with your club and then it would move? That's even easier. And the more distance there is between us and our actions, the easier it is. And I think from this perspective, the stock market these days, or the financial market, is creating lots of opportunities for distance, where people can very easily see their own actions as being very distant from the consequences of them. That's why I think it's so much easier to lie on expense report and in cash, why we find that, why it's easier to lie with stock options than with money, why it's easier to lie with mortgage-backed securities, with direct cash. All of those things are much, much easier once the distance is increasing. And in Madoff's case, there was a tremendous distance between what he was doing and what was happening to the investors.
Well, now that's a very interesting thesis and something that I wasn't going to follow up with, but let's do that. Let's talk about the whale trade that just happened at J.P. Morgan, and Jamie Dimon, who is the head of J.P. Morgan, had to testify in front of Congress. This was a trade that was done in the London office. It's going to lose, they were estimating somewhere between $2 billion and $9 billion for J.P. Morgan, and he had to testify in front of Congress. I'm not sure why, but we'll leave that issue aside for just a moment and say he had to testify. He had to rationalize this. He was far removed from it. It's a complex trade done in their London office, which is geographically removed. Was there this potential for the whale trade to go bad right from the start, given all of the variables, the distance, the complexity, et cetera?
Yeah, I think that the moment you start looking at something as not money, you start looking at it as something else, it is all of a sudden easy to think about it as a game and not to really take the consequences too seriously. So, you know, the industry that knows this best, of course, is Las Vegas. When you go to Las Vegas, they want you to take an amount of cash and move it into chips. Because once it's chips, it's one step removed from money. It's much easier to spend. Imagine you were going to Vegas and you would only put cash on the roulette wheel. That would be incredibly tough to put money down. But the moment it's not cash, it's something one step removed from money. Even though chips, it's easier. What if it's, you know, an esoteric instrument that you don't really understand, and there's all kind of assumptions, and you can fool yourself into believing something else? I think all of those things are creating much more opportunities for bad behavior. So, you know, I think that in the financial market, there's a question, are these good people or bad people? My conclusion is that the people are not bad. The situations that we put them in are really terrible. So imagine, for example, that I paid you $5 million a year to view mortgage-backed securities as a good product. Ask yourself, when you're under those conditions, you couldn't start seeing them truly as being better than they are.
Sure.
And I'm not asking whether you would lie to people, whether you would tell your customers, oh, these are really fantastic, but you would believe that they're awful. Wouldn't you actually start believing that they are better than they would?
Absolutely.
Of course you would. And what if they were hard to compute and you were sitting there with a big Excel spreadsheet and there's all kind of assumptions and parameters, and you could change some of those by slight amount, and all of a sudden you would see your bonus increasing? Wouldn't that be kind of tempting? And of course, there's the ultimate rationalization, which is everybody else is doing that.
Mm.
And we see that working very well, and it's working very well on Wall Street.
Well, I want to talk about the parameters and so forth. My guest is Dan Ariely, the author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. But I found it interesting, and this is to the heart of your point that you were trying to make here, that you found that it's very complex about why we lie, but two big findings. Number one is, first, if you remove the consequences, nearly everybody cheats at least a little bit. And then conversely, second, almost nobody cheats as much as they could. Talk
yes,
about
right.
that. That just is mind-boggling to me.
So the economic standard theory is very simple, right? It says basically you only consider the external cost and benefit. You think to yourself, what do I stand to gain? What do I stand to lose if I'm being caught? And is it worth it? Now, if you think about it from that perspective, you could probably reflect on the last few days and play back in your mind how many opportunities you had to steal money and then nobody else would ever find out. And you could probably find many of those opportunities, right? You must have been in somebody's house, and you went to the bathroom, and you passed by something that you could have taken. Some of your friends might have left something unlocked in their offices. I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities to steal all kinds of stuff. And most of those, we don't take those opportunities, and we don't even think about that. And that's because we have an internal compass. We have what we call morals, right? We have this idea that even if nobody else would watch us, we care about that. And that's, by the way, the great news about human beings. The interesting thing about the way our morality and conscience work is they don't prevent us from being dishonest perfectly. They don't make us perfectly honest. They make us almost perfectly honest. So it's a very good news, but it's not perfect. It's not perfect news. Now, here is the challenging thing. The big element to talk about is the element of rationalization. Because if you want to view yourself as a moral person, the question is, can you act immorally and rationalize it? And to the extent that you can act immorally and rationalize it, it all of a sudden will become easier to keep on thinking of yourself as moral and at the same time being dishonest. So, for example, if you say to yourself, everybody else does that, all of a sudden you feel perfectly okay behaving immorally. Take the topic of illegally downloaded music.
Right.
I think all young people today, or virtually all of them, have no moral problems with that. When I ask my students about it, and I say, what would happen if the New York Times tomorrow published your name and said that you were found to have illegally downloaded music on your computers? Nobody cares. Why? Because those domains are so acceptable, and people have rationalized to such a degree, they say to themselves, everybody's doing it, and it's really not hurting the artist, and I wouldn't have bought it anyway. And I'm really just helping spread the music around. And they have these fantastic stories about why they're actually crusaders. You know, you listen to these young people rationalize it, you would think that they are kind of fighting for freedom as they download illegal music, not that they're doing anything bad. Now, but as a society, as we move from something that becomes a moral issue, and we move through a period in which everybody rationalizes it, and now there's the risk that nobody feels bad about it. And I think there's other domains in life that we're moving toward that. So as a university professor, I think that plagiarism is one of those areas when people are finding more and more, kids are finding it easier and easier to plagiarize and not feel bad about it.
Mm.
I think that insider trading, I've talked to lots of insider traders, and you know, one of them told me that he never met a trader that he did not do insider trading. And if you think about being exposed to that environment, you have to ask yourself, what is holding them back, right? Or do they feel bad about it? Of course, if they are caught, they feel bad about it. But is there something internal that is holding them back? And I think in many areas of their life, our lives, we're losing that.
All right. My guest is Dan Ariely. He's the author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, which then brings up the bigger question, the overriding question. How much of our flexible honesty is innate, and how much of it is learned behavior?
That's a fantastic question. I don't have a good answer for, but I suspect at least some of it is learned. And, you know, the truth is we all have to admit that we teach our kids how to lie all the time, right? And we lie all the time, right? It's not just in a professional domain. We all tell our kids that the answer to the question, honey, how do I look in that dress, is not to tell the truth, right? We tell our kids basically that there's lots of human values and that honesty is just one of them. And when different human values come to contradict each other, we need to think which one is more important so we don't offend other people. We don't point at them. We don't exactly say what's in our mind all the time. We care about the well-being of other people. And you know, money is also a value. We want to have money. And what happens when money runs into honesty? So the truth is that we create an environment in which we teach our kids that the truth is just one other value that can be traded off with other values. And we teach our kids very strange lessons about how these are traded off. And, of course, society rewards us for being dishonest in social ways, in all kinds of ways, right? Giving people compliments, not offending them, not telling the truth, and so on. And therefore, I think it's a complex issue. It's a complex balance. Now, of course, in a social life, you would not want everybody to be honest all the time. It would be awful to live with somebody who told you all the time exactly how they think about you.
Right, a sycophant.
But in the business world, when we interact with other people, and when the consequences of our dishonesty could be as tremendous as the ones in the stock market, I think those are cases we have to be much more careful.
All right. Well, it's interesting. My guest is Dan Ariely. So, Dan, you've identified several factors that influence the amount that people will cheat or lie in general. So give us some of those societal or personal constraints that limit the amount of lying and the amount of cheating that we do.
So one of them is basically being reminded about your own moral fiber. So when we get people to try and recall the Ten Commandments, or when we get atheists to swear on the Bible, or when we get people to sign an honor code, code of conduct for professional organization help. Basically, it's about reminders at the moment of temptation really help. Another thing is to try and eliminate conflicts of interest. If you realize that conflicts of interest basically skew our perspective and get us to see reality in an inaccurate way, then you want to think about where you want to eliminate your own conflicts of interest. And, of course, the conflicts of interest of those who are dealing with you, think doctors, dentists, and so on. It also turns out that something like the Catholic Confession ends up being very useful. You know, the Catholic Confession on its face of it seems very strange, because if you can confess and get absolved, wouldn't you cheat more? But the reality is that what the Catholic Confession does is to help people start a new page. And the moment you have sinned and you ask forgiveness and you say what you have done, all of a sudden you can basically open a new page. Because if you have sinned a lot and you can't open a new page, why would you ever stop? You know, people in dieting know it very well. You know, you start a diet, you eat something very bad, and then you say, what the hell? You know, I messed my diet. I might as well enjoy fries and a steak today.
The old slippery slope.
Yeah.
Well, now, Dan, one of the other things, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but one of the things that I found interesting was wearing counterfeit clothing and merchandise as opposed to the real thing influences the amount that people will lie and the amount people will cheat. What's the connection there?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that, you know, if we act in one domain immorally, like download illegal music, and then we go to play soccer, you know, there's no influence between the two domains. They're kind of completely separate. One of them is at home, and when you listen to music, you might think about the fact that they're illegally downloaded, and the other one, it doesn't carry over. But when you have a fashion item that is counterfeit, it's not the same fashion item, right? Music, a song is the same song, regardless of whether it's you paid for it or not. It's the same file. But glasses are not the same glasses. And not only that, but you keep on wearing it. You're wearing them and you walk around with them. And now you almost have a constant reminder that you're kind of a cheat, that you're not perfectly honest, that something about you is not perfectly kosher. And it's as if you've taken the first step in that domain as well. So usually we find it as a separation between different domains, but fashion is a separate issue, because it does transform different areas. It basically kind of covers a whole range of experiences, and if you do something in one domain, it could also influence other domains.
Well, it's a fascinating example. My guest has been Dan Ariely, author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Now, Dan, you've probably piqued the interest of many of my listeners. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
So my website is danariely.com. It's Dan, D-A-N. Ariely is A-R-I-E-L-Y, and I have all kinds of videos and explanations of all my books, and also links of where you can buy the book, and I think I have a very good blog as well.
Dan, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.